Okay, we can get started. Did someone join while we were pressing the buttons to record this? Oh,
yep,
Glow?
It's me. This is Glow. Hi, everybody.
Glow, you just got back from Disney World. Lucky duck.
I did. It was great. We had so much fun, just my husband and I. No kids, no grandkids. Just the two of us.
Fun. Well, we're going to get started. And in fact, while we've got you on the line, Glow, why don't you give us some news from Washington? But someone else just joined recently. Who is
Jorge
that?
Jorge Gutierrez from Florida State College.
Hey, Jorge, how are you?
I'm good, you?
Good. And someone else?
Holly is on.
Okay. Okay, Holly. Where are you from?
I'm Callie Hazan. I'm from Employment Skills Center in Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
Oh, great. Okay. Good. We're going to be talking about recruitment and retention and WIBs and PICs and how to get our best people in and what to do once we get them in. But why don't we start out with Glow? She's going to give us any news you may have heard from Washington other than the election that we're all, all excited
Boy.
About.
You know, I wish I had some news to say, but I emailed my project officer yesterday and have not heard back from her, so which is pretty rare. She always replies. So I have a feeling that they've been busy preparing for the RFP release and that the election yesterday may have slowed things down a little bit. I don't know, but I didn't hear anything, so I have no word from headquarters on anything right now.
Okay.
The only thing from us is that, from us here at HMTRI, we are in the planning stages for next year's all-grantee meeting. We sent out an RFP for the location of our meeting next August. It's due back the first part of December, so we should be able to at least announce the date for next year's meeting. But that's as much as I can say right now, other than it will be during the month of August.
Great. Now, other news, which we're going to put in the post-session notes, are some training opportunities that I included last week, but also I'll put them in this week for those of you who are new. These are training opportunities for trainers. These are train-the-trainer type things. There's several different programs that are available to our Bronfield grantees and also other people who are thinking of starting. These would be primarily if you have an organization where you can have your own trainer. We have a Greatest Institute in June, from the June 4th to 16th, and that seems like a long way away, but it fills up very fast because they teach trainers how to deliver a 40-hour, 24-hour hazardous awareness. DOT has its materials. It's a very comprehensive boot camp where you go to Iowa, spend time there, active training, and excellent, but it fills up fast. But it is open to our environmental workforce development job training people who are going to be trainers. There's also an announcement about a disaster site worker program that's a train-the-trainer and a DOT. But I'm going to put those in the post-session notes so you could look at them. And if you either have a trainer or one on board or someone you may want to send to this training, you may want to look at that and pass it on to them. And then there's contact information on how they can get a hold of the people that we work with, NIEHS, to sign up for these train-the-trainer programs. They're excellent programs. And we did have an inquiry during the week about training, and we'll talk about that, but it's interesting that you have to be real careful when you're especially in the HAZWOPR. And some of these are also programs where the trainer has to be certified. So you have to... It's not like a traditional program where you order a textbook and then you just set out to train. You have to have your trainers well qualified to do that. I did have another question during the week, and it had to do, and what we've been doing in this cohort before the and during the RFP as it came out, we've been talking about the critical components of an environmental job training program. And it just so happens that those critical components are what you're going to have to address when you write the RFP. So I wouldn't say that this is a pre-prep for writing an RFP proposal, but it's things you're going to want to include in that proposal because they're a collection of the best practices of our grantees over the years. We started off, for those of you who just joined, with the first step is, and I like to work backwards, and I'm going to repeat that several times because what you want to do is work backwards. First, looking at your community and your labor market assessment. So when you're thinking of starting one of these programs, or if you have a program and you want to give it a fresh look, work backwards. Look at your community, and you'll look at the labor market, and you want to see what that labor market looks like, what kind of jobs may be available, who in that community would be your potential employers, what kind of things are they going to be looking for. And also, and I have two components, the community assessment and the labor market assessment. The community assessment, we're going to talk a little bit about when we go into the recruitment. Your community is within this broad area where you may have jobs and Superfund sites and brownfield sites. You're going to have different communities, and you have to be very careful of how you choose the target community you want to work with. And we're going to come back to that in a second. But the question I had is, how do we identify some of these communities that you talked about in that session on community and labor market assessments? And I'm going to include in the notes two really good sites. I've mentioned EJ Screen several times, and I'll give you the address to that. And it's a mapping tool put out by EPA that's got all kinds of demographic information, down to 1,400 people. It's got all the things you need to get really good demographic information. There's another site that I haven't talked about in quite a while. It's called Cleanups in My Community. And I'll give you the site address for that in the post-session notes. And that identifies also all the brownfields. It'll identify Superfund sites, all the activities that will be going on. And that's a big help when you're trying to locate and writing your proposal of what's in your community. Those are both EPA products. They're very specific, very definitive, and these are the kind of things you want to have in your proposal. So that was a question that was asked referring to the session we had on community and labor market assessments. The last PLC we did, after you kind of zero in on your community, the next thing we talked about that was most important in working backwards is establishing your partnerships. Once you identify community, who are your partners going to be, and who are you going to be your employment partners, your service partners, who are going to be your potential participant partners, and where are you going to get your services. So those two things really lead us into what's next. And the next component is what we're going to talk about today, and that's recruitment, student evaluations, and support services. And I've kind of lumped these all into one because they're all interrelated, and they kind of reflect back onto the partnerships program we talked about and the assessing your community and your labor market. And I'm going to sound kind of callous here, but we have 25 or so people that we have seats for. And I'd rather look at or have grantees look at this whole recruitment process as like you are choosing your basketball team rather than I'm going in, I'm going to do good in the community because there's tremendous unemployment and I can train people and they can get jobs and we're going to do better things. And that is really good for a program that has large numbers of people they could train. This program, it asks for at least 70% and maybe up to 80%. Some of our grantees are placing 100% of their people. And what I'm trying to say is it's a very selective program. So you have to work backwards again, as I said before. You have to find out what your employer's needs are. And then when we talk about recruitment, and even when we talk about establishing our community assessment, what types of people will these employers hire? And here's where we get callous. You may have 100 or even 1,000. We've seen employment programs that were summer programs that had 1,000 applicants, and they had 100 slots. Well, in our case, you may not have 1,000 applicants, but you have about 25 slots, and you've got to ration those slots. And what you have to do is, to be fair, give them to the most deserving, the most likely to succeed individuals that you can. In other words, I'm sorry to say you have to cherry pick. Now, you can deviate from that. And you could change the scope of your program. You could have a program that has to do with ex-offenders. But within that community of ex-offenders, you're going to have to pick those ex-offenders that you can place, that have the desire and have the ability, and that you can place. You're doing no one any good to bring someone off the street without a job, give them some $4,000 worth of certifications, give them training, give them life skills, and then he not be able to get a job for whatever reason, because you didn't screen properly. You're actually doing him more harm than if he never came into training. So you really have to be, and when I say cherry pick, I don't want to give it the bad connotation. You have to take all of your potentials. Again, pretend you're choosing a basketball team. You've got 50 people that want to play, and you've got to pick a winning team that you can relate to, that you know you could place. So at the end of it, you've got to be able to place them. There have been people, some of our grantees have actually had employers on the screening team. I can work with this fella. I can't work with this fella. So again, it sounds kind of callous, but you're one of the biggest failures. When we have catastrophic results from grantees, it's usually often first-year grantees, and they say, and I remember one at an all-grantee meeting, and we were sitting on the side, and he said, Mike, I made a huge mistake because it was our first year, and we just had to get people into the program. And I picked people in, brought them in, and they were a disaster. They didn't have the motivation. They really didn't have the smarts that I needed to get my program going. They caved on me. They dropped out on me. And the program was a disaster. So in my mind, it's a shame and a waste of the $200,000. And it's a waste of those seats. And the worst part of it, there were probably people in that community that could have succeeded but didn't because of the non-capability of the grantee to understand that I got to fill up 25 seats and I'm just going to go out and I'm going to take the first 25 or the 25 that the WIB sends to me. So this is the backdrop I want to place on you on where do we go from next. And you say, okay, we're going to pick the best 25. We're going to choose our target group, whether it's maybe it's women, maybe it's a part of the community. Maybe it's a particular part of the community that's got a certain type of gang or social club, we might call them. You're going to have to look at those groups when you're doing your community assessment, and you're going to have to start saying, okay, how could this team, will this team work together? Are they eager to learn? Are they going to come to all the classes? Are they just filling the seat? Are they really going to be motivated? And more important is when we're through with all this, can I place them? And that's, again, the key is placement, because that's what this program is all about. So, again, we choose our target group very selectively. We have to try to minimize disparities, both cultural, educational, geographic. And, again, I'm sounding kind of callous, and I listen to myself, and I'm thinking, gee, that doesn't sound very good. You're really picking the cream of the crop, but I'm looking at it very realistically and placing 20 to 25 people in good jobs that have excellent certifications. And these are people who needed those jobs, and they're in the community, and they deserve the jobs, and they want the jobs. So you've got to look at it from that perspective. Besides the when you're choosing that group, they have to have an education, the more narrow you can choose your group, the easier it is going to be to train them and do a good job of training. Because, again, if you have someone who has not been in a classroom in 40 years and someone who just got out of high school and is sharp as a tack, you're going to have a lot of disparity in education. You're going to drive your instructor crazy. You either bring the class down to the lowest common denominator unless you could do some kind of individualized learning plan. So where everyone's going at their own pace. So, and if you have the luxury of being able to do that, that's fine. But the narrower geographically you can do it. Also, you've got to consider things like how do the students get to class? If this is more of a problem in rural areas, but in large urban areas it could be a problem, because if someone lives on the north side, your training program is in the central part of the city, and maybe the job is on the south side, you've got to think about, will this realistically, this fellow has to take 3 buses to get to class, classes start at 7 o'clock every day, and he may have to, if he's going to get through the program, he's going to have to go to work on the south side, and then how is he going to get home unless he moves? So you've got to think, keep these things in mind in your recruitment process, because I don't care how determined he is, if he just can't make it work, he's going to drop out after a while because it's just too hard to get to class. So again, where your training facility is, and ideally your training facilities are fairly close to your target audience, they can get to class easy, and hopefully your employers will be, in an urban area, it's a lot easier if there's good transportation services. They can take buses or transportation. If you're in a rural area, you may have to make arrangements, and we'll talk about support services in just a second, so that he can get to the job. Again, you've got to, we're working backwards. You got to get the guy to the job. You got to get him to training, and you've got to make them in a cultural group that works together. And so they've got to be able to relate to each other. And how do you recruit this team? Okay, well let's go into. Everything you sounds okay, but okay, how am I going to get these people, particularly if this is my first year? Often, when you do your community assessment, you may find a neighborhood, and there's some churches. Some of our best grantees operate highly, highly on referrals. Someone will go through the program in a community, and they got some great jobs. Pretty soon, their cousins are going, their sisters are going, their brothers are going. And they're all friends, and they know each other, and they get to know each other really well. And here's an example of, it's a fairly narrow close group, but they're more like friends. They're a close-knit group of friends. So that's not a bad way to do it. Now, we always suggest that everyone use the WIB, the Workforce Investment Board, and Workforce Development Board, whatever you want to call it, the one-stop, the PIC. These are all terms for the Department of Labor programs that everyone goes to when they need a job, and they have huge computer banks, and you fill out the forms, and you go through the interviews, and they qualify you. And these are massive programs, and this is the big difference between this EPA program, which is a very, very small, almost undetectable program when you talk about jobs programs, and the big labor programs. But what the WIBs bring, or the one-stops, they can bring a lot of screening to the table. They can bring a lot of people who are coming into this program, and this is a positive and it's a negative. They bring in a lot of people, and if you can develop a relationship with the Workforce Investment Board or the one-stops, or particularly the one-stops in the community that you're going to be serving, you could say, we need your services. We want to qualify the people that are coming in the program with the Workforce Investment Board and Department of Labor Benefits, but we need to do some more screening. And so perhaps you can give us a starting list with the understanding that after we get this list, we've got some more screening we've got to do. So the Workforce Investment Board, they could do the TABE test. Some of them do that. It's a 9th or 10th grade TABD test. They might do work keys in some states, or CASAS. These are standardized tests to measure the mathematical and the verbal skills of individuals. That could get you, that could narrow your group down so that you don't have the huge educational disparities where I was talking about earlier. So that's one very useful thing of WIBs, and they'll test people. They might even do some other things that you can't do in terms of making sure they're qualified for benefits. They can also help you with the placement later on, but we'll talk about that at a different time. You're going to have to, in some cases, have a physical ability test. If you've got SCBAs, all kinds of respiratory protection, or you may have to have some weight ability to lift a weight up to 50 pounds or something. Many of our programs are women's programs, and they do very well. You hate to even talk so much about physical abilities except for when it has to do with health and safety. If they have to climb ladders, You may have to, in your curriculum, you may have to have the ability to climb ladders or have some physical, because they just can't get through the program without it. Or you may have to alter your program and have them on a separate path. But that's another criteria. Then we get to the subjective selective measures, which I think are the most important of all of these. Through the WIB, you've done your academic, you've narrowed your academic scope down so you know that they can do the work. You've maybe checked their physical ability so that if they have to climb ladders or if they've got heart problems, you know about that. Now we get to the point of, are you going to be able to place this person? Is he going to be appealing to potential employers, he or she? Does he have a passion for doing a new career? Does that individual work well in groups? When you form your team, like your basketball team, they're going to have to play together, and they're going to have to work well together and be friends. If you've got someone who's a loner and does not work well with people, it's a red flag. Again, we're rationing seats, unfortunately. So we want a team that can work together. You may want to bring this group together before you finalize it. Are they going to stick with the program? And that gets back to the whole issue of transportation. Where do they live? Where did you define your target group? You may want to do Northeast Philadelphia in a certain section of the city where there are some employers there, there's some waste sites, and your training facility is nearby, and there's a bus line that goes right to your facility. So this is what I'm getting at. Make it as easy for the people to get there that they become a team. They get to know each other, and it's almost like a graduating class. And our grantees who are really successful, they keep in touch, and we'll talk about this at another date. They use Facebook, Twitter. Their families are together. They become a new extended family, and this is really what we're looking at and what we're trying to do. So, how do we again filter these subjective types of things? And we usually, again, this is sounding a little cruel, but we run them through their paces to the point where those who are not willing to do this are those who are willing to put up with the stuff that you're going to throw at them are the ones that will get through the program, and they will be the most deserving. And what I'm talking about, you might have an awareness night. You may have some games at the awareness night, an open house. And you may have a couple of awareness nights, one subsequent to the other. So, and what I'm talking about is a filtering process. After that, you may have this application process. It's not easy. An application that's got a lot of things to fill out, a lot of materials, takes time to fill out. It's a pain in the butt. But again, that's what we're trying to do, because if they don't want to fill out an application, how are they going to get through all your certifications? You may have at least one personal interview in a group. You may have family visits. Our best grantees will actually get to know the families. So, again, and we're not talking about thousands of people. We're talking about 25 people. So we want to get to know them and get as intimate as we can with them and among them so that they're working together. So, again, this application process, and a lot of people will put their applications on the internet, and that's fine. Make sure you have the awareness nights. Make sure you go through, let them fill out the applications on the internet. That's great. Make sure you do the interviews. Have them come to the training center many times so they're used to it. If it's too hard to get to the center, they're going to drop out. No, they're going to self-filter is what they're going to do. That's one approach that's used, and many of these are used together in conjunction. One that is very popular with our grantees and at our annual grantee meeting, we always have them demonstrate, is what OII does in Chicago. It's called tryouts. And what they do is bring people together in one of these open houses, or they may have special sessions. They're not even in the program yet, and they do exercises, working together, trust exercises, moving things like moving little houses around, blindfolded, and only describing one to the other what to do. So they're exercises that are done to see how people work together in groups, or if they get frustrated or they can't work in groups or they have anger management problems. So they're really trying to ferret out those people, again, from a larger group to a smaller group of again, almost like basketball tryouts, you know, same kind of thing. Another approach that people use, now I've talked about using this difficult application process. I talked about the tryout process. There's a third thing that many grantees use that's very effective. And you may or may not, depending on your partners, be able to use this technique. It's I call it pre-training, where the easiest pre-training is someone who's in a construction program, and you've got a partner who may be a young community developer or a youth build program, and you've got participants who have been screened and are in a training program, and you're able to link as a partner your program to theirs, and you're able to go in. And they may even be part of your program. You may have a youth build program, and you're adding on the Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Program to it. You want to be able to observe over an extended period of time your students in this prior training program. So he's learning construction skills, for example, and you're able to work with him, get to know him, see how he performs in the group, and you're basically doing a long-term interview to get to know that person. As they finish that program, you may want to approach them and say, you've done a great job in construction skills. Would you be interested in enhancing those skills and getting environmental certifications, whether it's lead remediation or whether it's some sort of a, you'll get the HAZWOPer so you can go on waste sites, confined space, asbestos, because he's already got the construction skills. He's got a lot of the training from that, and you've been observing him. So it's almost like, again, the basketball tryouts. He's been playing ball with you for a while, and you're picking the best of the crop. And you might tell me, well, I don't have a construction training program. Well, you could do the same thing with a life skills program, and instead of doing life skills embedded later in the program after they're accepted, open your program up and do some life skills training and maybe some health and safety and first aid. So you could get those service programs out of the way early before you even bring the person into the environmental program. In other words, you might have some applicants, and you might have 50 applicants, and you train, give an opportunity to learn some first aid, some life skills, some resume writing, some verbal skills, interacting with people, and all the time you're really running them through your screening application process. And you're going to, again, pick the best of those individuals and then bring them into your environmental program. Now, this all sounds like a lot of work, but I would say that you choose a good team, your life is going to be so much easier. You're going to train easier. You're not going to have retention issues. You're not going to have people dropping out because you know them. You're going to have people that you know you can place because you're thinking of this all the time. Is this individual placeable? So by doing this, it's really a great way, again, working backwards and picking the best crew. And it's the old, you know, if you don't have good feedstock, you're just going to struggle. And that's the alternative. When you know nothing that I've just described about that person, you've got to be really lucky to have gotten all good individuals, and 70, 80, 90%. I think one of our grantees who has 100% placement, he has a construction program, a youth build program, and he's able to run them through youth build and offer the most desirable, the most motivated, the ones that can handle the program that he knows are reliable, give them these extra certification training so he can get some great jobs. So when we talk about that recruitment, that's what we need to do. The last thing I want to talk about is support services. And we can pick the best community. We're nearby that community. We have our training facilities. We've picked motivated people. How do we keep them involved in the program? And we could have all of those traits, but sometimes people have personal issues that they can't handle. And unfortunately, the environmental EPA, Environmental Job Training Program, does not allow you to pay for those student services that you really need to provide all of your students. The the program is designed because of a, you know, the federal, it's an EPA program. It's not a Department of Labor program. EPA program, EPA money has to do training for EPA certifications, particularly things associated with brownfields, site cleanup. So the money can only be spent for the recruitment, training, and placement of environmental remediation workers. So where does this other stuff come in, that the issues that these people may have? Now, as I first described, the narrower, the more you're able to cherry pick and choose people that don't need these services, of course, the less you need of them. But that's unrealistic. Everyone needs help. And so you may have to provide some extra services. And I talked early on about the WIBs. WIBs are great because they provide these services. And we're talking about things like remedial education in some cases, life skills education. We talk about things like financial literacy. It might even be anger management, those types of skills you need to get up every day to get to work. You may have people who need child care assistance, whether it's a he or she may have kids at home. They may be excellent workers. They may be motivated workers. They would be employable workers after you train them with certifications. They have child care issues, and that child is more important than anything in their life. They may end up having to drop out because they need to take care of the child. Or they may have transportation issues, which I already talked about. If they're on the other side of town and you've got someone blind and you didn't even ask him where he lives, how are you going to get to training at 8 o'clock every day and be reliable? And, you know, so you need to have transportation services. You may have, again, people who have made mistakes and they have legal issues. And, again, there are those services. And this program is designed so that EPA doesn't provide you the resources for that, but there's many of them out there. The WIB is one I mentioned. Financial literacy can be provided and leveraged with banks. Different people in the community are happy to provide in-kind assistance to do some financial literacy training. Might be a local community college. Health and Human Services may provide health care. The bus, some of our grantees in urban areas get special bus passes so their students can come in and take buses. It's great when they may have a downtown training center and they've got people coming in on bus lines, and it's easy for them to get to class all the time, and they can even get to their employers easily with bus passes. There may be some legal aid services that you need to go. And this goes back to our discussion we had about choosing your partners. These are people who are going to be providing these non-supportive services, and they're a lot easier than you might think. It's in their best interest to provide these services because it's part of their mission. So you're going to have to separate all of this out. And as I said, the more narrow your restrictive your recruitment is, the less likely you're to have to need these support services. But I wouldn't count on, you're going to have them, and you need someone to provide them. So I would definitely approach these potential partners. Now, everything I just said are things you're going to want to write into your grant. That'll be coming out between now and the next PLC, and we'll get into that then. But everything I just discussed are things that will be the difference between someone who says, oh, we're going to provide support services, or, oh, we're going to do recruitment from the WIB, versus the competitor who is submitting a grant that says, this is how we're going to recruit. We're going to use this three-step process. We're going to do a WIB screening. We're going to qualify all students who can qualify for ETA services. We're going to, in addition to that, we're going to do this, this, and this, or we're going to do tryouts, or we're going to do some pre-training. When the reviewers review the grant proposals, they want specifics, not generalities. So that's going to be the difference between the grant that is succeeding, because they have all of those things in it, and the grant that's going to go to the back of the pile. And so this is kind of why we're talking about all of these issues. You know, we have some people on the line, and I'm already past my 30 minutes. And would anyone like to contribute to this and what they've done or found very successful in terms of recruiting and working, or even horrible experiences in terms of their recruitment process? Anyone out there? I can't overemphasize how important this recruitment is. Almost as important, unfortunately, everything is important, but the recruitment can be a landmine for you if you don't have a good process. And I think it's also very important that you include this in your proposal if you're going to be submitting this year. Now, our next PLC, because Thanksgiving, we do these every other week, and the next one we're going to be talking about curriculum, but that would normally fall on the day before Thanksgiving, so we're not going to do that. So we're going to have our next PLC on the 30th of November, and we'll continue this discussion and talk about curriculum. Now, between now and then, I am almost sure that the RFP will come out. It was supposed to be mid-November, so that'll put it next week when it'll be coming out. And Glow, I'm sure we'll be sending you plenty of copies of the RFP as soon as it comes out.
I'll put it out on the listserv.
That'd be great. And we'll be talking about that in the future. When you get it and look at it, it'll be very similar to last year. The things we're going to be talking about in the future are some controversial things like it's going to feed into our next discussion on curriculum. What can you train to? In the past, for example, AIR Programs was not putting any money into this program, so they didn't want you to do AIR training. They may be in this year, and we'll find out. There may be some things that are in there, some things that are not, some things that are funded very heavily, and the people who are putting the money into this pot would like to make sure that they're getting their money's worth. And vice versa, those who are putting money into the pot don't want to see their money going to train some other program office that is out of their mandate. So that's one thing we're going to be looking at. The rest of it will be fairly the same. They may upgrade the percentage placement that they're looking for. It's around 70% now. I've heard talk they like to see it even a little higher. So, but we'll see, and we'll analyze it and compare it with last year's. In the meantime, and I've sent that last year's out, I would use last year's as a guide, and that would work well. Anything anyone to discuss or question? Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate and I hate to sound like a talking head on this. These calls that we're having right now are more instructive. Later on, in future PLCs, we'll be having our grantees talk about their experiences and what they're doing. But right now, we're kind of focused on these critical components that are going to have to do with you and either improving your existing grant or in writing your new grant to be successful. So. Well, thank you, everyone, and we'll send out post-session notes in the next couple of days, and hopefully see you on the 30th of November. So have a good afternoon, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Great call, Mike.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Have a good one.